car and a boat now. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air with listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And this hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.centraliljwj.org. That's centraliljwj.org.
I've never heard dub before. Abbreviation for WW.
Okay. Okay. Triple dub. Triple yeah, dub. There you go. www.
Okay.
centraliljwj.
That's almost redundant anymore. Everybody knows this. That's the prefix, you know.
That it's www.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them you don't even need the dub, you know, WEFT. You don't need the www in front of that. So.
Okay. All
anyway,
right.
But yeah, dub. I'm sorry.
That's okay. All right,
comes from the reggae show I was doing dub.
Okay. So we got some news stories, and I guess I'll just start with one, then we'll go to...
Oh, hang on a minute.
Yes.
I'd like to... I've been looking for some Steve Earle music because I'd like to wish Steve Earle a happy 60th birthday today.
Okay. All right. All right. So as far as the news, the Teamsters Union and the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York filed an application with Chief Judge Loretta Preska requesting that she remove an agreement to end decades of government oversight over the Teamsters Union. International Brotherhood President Jim Hoffa. Hoffa said agreement with the government's signals success in efforts to drive organized crime corruption from the Teamsters, and he expects the judge to approve it. And quote, James Hoffa, we anticipate that she'll approve that agreement. This is a historic day for our Teamsters. After decades of hard work and millions of dollars spent, we can finally say that corrupt elements have been driven from the Teamsters. You know, we could do a whole program on the Teamsters sometime in this history of corruption. And anyway, Bob?
Yeah, I got a story here that was about a week old. In St. Louis, the adjunct faculty have won a victory for part-time faculty. On January 5th, Washington University in St. Louis, adjuncts announced they had voted 138 to 111 to join the Service Employees International Union, SEIU Local 1. The vote was part of SEIU's Adjunct Action Campaign, a push to organize adjunct instructors at the citywide level, not just through individual schools. The successful vote continues a trend of part-time instructors at major colleges and universities organizing to gain the pay and benefits enjoyed by their full-time colleagues and push back against the increasingly precarious nature of academic work. Washington University employs over 400 adjunct professors in almost all subjects. Adjuncts typically teach part-time for lower wages than full-time professors and are not eligible for tenure. Often they work on semester-long contracts, not knowing which, if any, courses they will teach the following term. If courses are cut due to lack of enrollment or a full-time instructor wants to teach it, adjunct instructors do not get paid. So to combat these working conditions, adjunct instructors have been actively organizing several campaigns. Recent months have seen a number of successes for adjuncts around the country. Last April, adjuncts at Baltimore's Maryland Institute College of Art voted to join SEIU Local 500. In December, adjuncts at Temple University in Philadelphia voted to organize with the American Federation of Teachers. Later that same month, an NLRB ruling at Pacific Lutheran University set the stage for instructors at religious institutions to organize. And adjunct organizing campaigns are underway in 22 states right now. There's also another part to this story. It says in Illinois, in Chicago, there's unions covering contingents in all the public sector and two of the privates, Roosevelt and Columbia, and the NEA, Illinois Education Association, effort to organize East-West University after years of unfair labor practices was finally abandoned after the entirely contingent faculty was simply replaced. In the past year, a joint AFT-AAUP project succeeded in organizing the University of Illinois, Chicago, and a separate bargaining unit from the tenure-track faculty, but bargaining together as a joint union. And at the U of I Urbana-Champaign, a unit has been established representing contingents who work over 50% through car check. There's also things going on, like they say, in 20 universities who've joined this adjunct action in the past 2 years. That includes Dominican University, St. Mary's College, and Otis College of Art and Design at California, and also Howard University, Georgetown University, Washington, D.C., Tufts University, and Northeastern and Boston have all voted for unionization. So
okay.
A growing trend. You can check that out yourself at adjunctaction.org.
Okay. I was just at a Jobs of Justice this morning and got an update about locally here in Illinois, the U of I and also the U of I Springfield campus.
Springfield too.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And Chicago has started, but it's not anywhere along the lines where, you know, the success at Springfield campus and the has obtained in U of I as well here on Urbana-Champaign.
Growing trend nationwide.
Yes, indeed. So, that's good. That's great. Over 100 people packed a hearing room at the Wisconsin State Capitol Wednesday to weigh in on the Assembly School Accountability Bill. The controversial bill was presented last week by Education Committee Chair Representative Thiesfeldt. The bill lays out a mandate for public schools that receive a failing grade for 4 consecutive years to convert to a private corporate charter format. Milwaukee's Democratic Representative Christine Sinicki took the chair to task for the bill's potentially devastating impact on the state's education budget. Rachel Schluter, who had been teaching in Milwaukee public school systems for 25 years, while she agrees that accountability is essential, she says the legislator has to do a better job. She's quoted as saying, "This is very important to our children. We have so many children in MPS who need that community-based school. We've seen so many voucher schools up and leave in the middle of the night. We had a high school that left around 200 students without a school. Their parents had to look for an alternative right after vacation." Schulter also described the way that broader social problems such as poverty, violence, and inequality affect children's performance in school, issues that bills such as the one on the table do not address. Okay, Bob, do you have anything else as far as newsroom or Bill? I'm sorry.
Our guest might have some comment on that particular story right there.
Indeed. And we're going to get right into that here in just a second.
Yeah. I got one other story I wanted to do today. Exactly 100 years ago today, it was on a windblown gray Chicago day. 100 years ago today, Ralph Chaplin left his home on the city's south side for a raucous poor people's rally at Hull House, famed settlement house co-founded by Jane Addams. He asked a visiting friend he'd met organizing coal miners with Mother Jones to listen to the lyrics of a new tune he'd been working on. That was Solidarity Forever. So self-described Chicago stiff and rebel editor merely wanted to write a song that could be for workers what John Brown's Body, Battle Hymn of the Republic were for abolitionists. In fact, he borrowed the very melody. So it says 100 years later, despite the rise and precipitous fall of workers' movements in the U.S., Chaplin's song is a classic, still widely sung with fists raised and demands for justice submitted. It's an international and national anthem, still regularly belted out by Occupy and sung every weekday by crowds from 20 to 100 protesters at the Wisconsin State Capitol Rotunda. So 100 years ago today, Solidarity Forever from Ralph Chaplin.
Okay.
I do have a comment about that. Is that nobody knows that song anymore.
Really?
Okay. It's, I don't know it.
Okay.
I don't know anybody. I probably do not work on any construction jobs where there is any person at all who knows that song. Number two, I was in Springfield one time. I think it was one of the big Labor Day lobby days.
Yeah.
At which we should have a giant one this year too.
Yeah, we should. We should.
Like we did in the 90s.
Good point, Bill.
And Jan Schakowsky,
yes.
One of the few Congress critters that I have any kind of respect for, she was trying to lead, I think it was about 15,000 people in that song, and like, you know, nobody knew it. What I'm saying is we got to get this culture back, and the unions aren't doing any good. They could, all these local unions, they could start every meeting singing it, you know, or something like that. And then when we do get to a rally, we can do it.
Okay. Interesting point, Bill. Yes.
It says, it is we who plowed the prairies, build the cities where they trade, dug the mines and build the workshops, endless miles of railway laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made.
Wow, powerful lyrics. Yeah. Okay, we're going to play a version of that right now. We're going to take a music break. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT, Listen Supported Community Radio Station. We'll be right back with some public service announcements and our very special guests who are live here in the studio. So stay tuned.
Inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. There can be no greater power anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
Okay, that was one version of Solidarity Forever. Bob, I didn't look who did that version.
Was that track one?
Yeah.
That was the Tom Morello
one. That was the Tom Morello one.
Night Watchman. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Very good. Okay, some quick public service announcements. Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice and the Urbana-Champaign Intermediate Center will host Reclaiming Martin Luther King's Radical Roots as part of a national effort to bring the Black Lives Matter campaign into the new year. We'll have invited readers, music, and refreshments and an open mic. Bring your favorite King speeches and reflections on them, or we'll supply copies of his more radical writings. Too often in the corporate media, we see a whitewashed Martin Luther King, but if King had been only a dreamer, they wouldn't have shot him. His words and actions of nearly 50 years ago were controversial at the time and remain profoundly radical today. We want to revisit his example to bring forth a 21st century grassroots campaign. We continue to be haunted by what King called the triplets of problems in America: racism, extreme materialism, and militarism. Now more than ever, we need a radical revolution against the new Jim Crow. That's mass incarceration, police brutality, and criminal justice system keeping African-American youths in shackle. What can we understand today's situations in the light of Martin Luther King's vision, and where does it lead us here? And that will be Sunday, January 25th, which is a week from this coming Sunday, from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Independent Media Center, which is 202 South Broadway, the older Urbana Post Office on the main floor. And again, it's January 25th from 2 to 4 p.m. And we'll remind you of that probably next week. Bob.
WEFT has a couple special programs kind of going on Monday, the 19th.
Mm-hmm.
Eunice Buckner Boone will be in from 6 to 8, I believe, doing her tribute to Martin Luther King.
Okay.
And I believe Democracy Now! Is going to – they've uncovered a never-before-heard speech by Martin Luther King. And that's going to be broadcast here.
Well, that'll be interesting.
4 o'clock on Monday afternoon.
Okay, very good.
Paul tried to do that this morning, but his file wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Okay.
Blew up or something.
Okay,
that's what he gets for buying Macs. Yeah. Apple.
And on Saturday, January 31st at 2 p.m. at the Champaign Public Library, Robeson Room A, will be Rich Whitney, the Illinois Green Party's nominee for governor in the elections of 2006 and 2010. In 2006, Rich Whitney received endorsements from several newspapers, including the Rockford Register Star, Southwest News Herald, and State School News Service. In that year's election, Whitney received 361,336 votes for almost 11% of the vote in Illinois. Rich is currently the Green Party state chairman, so he'll be speaking at the Champaign Public Library Saturday, January 31st at 2 p.m. And just to remind you, tune in this Sunday and every Sunday for Labor's Worldview TV from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 or live at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. Bill, do you have anything?
Well, I was just thinking about Rich Whitney, you know, in the Green Party. Mm-hmm. And it's really sad that they didn't have a big campaign run in the last election. I bet they could have pulled a third of the vote this time. People are so disgusted with the Democrats. And Bruce Rauner is just so...
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting 2 years.
You know,
for sure.
He could have probably got a million votes this time. I wish I could have done it. I wish I could have voted for him.
You know, I'm on a lot of different labor, websites and, also blogs, and, there were a lot of, teachers and state employees that, either didn't vote, they went and voted, but they left the governor's race blank. But there were some people so angry they actually voted for Rauner just to punish Quinn because of the state pension thing.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have an alternative.
That's the thing. Punish. I mean, it's not a very good strategy, but it's...
Too bad we don't have at least none of the above.
Well, that's what you do when you vote for I do this all the time.
Well,
you can see my ballots.
But they don't come out
in recent years.
But they don't come out and say, well, we had this many ballots that didn't have people vote for governor.
Very true. That's very true, bro.
Where they would have a none of the above.
Category, yes. Yeah. Okay.
It would be just fun to check that box.
Well, sure, indeed. But, you know, they don't want to publicize that. So anyway, we want to now, at this point, introduce our very special guests who are live here in the studio. Could you introduce yourselves, please?
I'm Kathy Mannon. I am a reading recovery teacher at Dr. Howard Elementary in Champaign.
My old grade school.
And I am the president of the Champaign Federation of Teachers.
Okay.
My name is Kevin Farrell. I'm a school psychologist at Cary Busey and Booker T. Washington Elementary. I'm also the CFT AFL-CIO delegate for Champaign County. And more recently, I'm the corresponding secretary for the AFL-CIO.
Okay. Well, great. I'm so glad to have you on the show. I mean, wow, it just seems like, during the course of our usual news stories, I mean, it's just, it seems like at least, at least once a month, if not every other week, it seems like we have some kind of, education or pension type of story involved. It's just, I think it's been especially in the last couple of years. Maybe we could start out by talking about what are some of the sort of the big challenges of public education at this point in time, would you say? I mean, I know it's a real broad question, but maybe you could talk about something that's relevant local or statewide.
That is a very broad question. I think one of the challenges that's currently in the forefront of teachers' minds in particular would be Common Core standards and the upcoming first administration of the PARC test. There have been a lot of challenges with that.
Excuse me.
Yes, go ahead.
What's that test you just mentioned?
Common Core and the other one?
The PARC test.
Yeah. Maybe you could explain both of those.
Sure.
To listeners.
So the Common Core standards are content area standards for English language arts and math.
Okay.
The idea being that as kids move through public education K-12, that they will be college or career ready when they graduate.
Okay.
The PARC test is the new standardized test that students will be required to take starting at grades 3 through 8, and in high school, I don't remember which grade.
It's through 11th grade.
Yeah. There's been a lot of controversy and frustration around the PARC test.
Mm-hmm.
It's computer-based. So one of the challenge for school districts is having the infrastructure to be able to facilitate that.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, particularly in the state of Illinois, with the way schools are funded, that we have a lot of inequities across the state as far as funding for public schools. And that has a huge impact on whether or not schools are able to successfully have that infrastructure.
Okay.
In place.
Let me ask you, how important do you think these two tests are? I mean, as far as results, I guess learning, I guess you will. I mean, because I understand there's a lot of controversy. It seems like everything's being focused on testing, and it takes away time, of course, from learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is a it does seem to take away time from learning. You know, you'll hear a lot about, as the test gets closer, people talking about teaching to the test, and sometimes that is encouraged from the top down, and sometimes it's not encouraged from the top down, and teachers feel the need to do it to try and maintain their employment, and that leads into the other issue that's upcoming, which is student growth as part of teacher evaluations, and so I think teachers start to feel pressured to try and achieve results on these tests.
I understand. I mean, I don't know all the details real good, but I understand there's been some teachers across the country have actually kind of refused to do these testing. I don't know if it was actually the core tests or not, but I saw some, you know, news blips of different parts of the country of teachers just flat refused to do any more testing. Was that the core testing, or was that some other additional tests piled on, like this PARC test?
I don't remember the specifics of that. I know they were standardized tests of some sort.
Yeah.
There is, you're starting to see this national opt-out movement. And in fact, in Florida this weekend is a national opt-out conference, actually, where, you know, parents, activists are there to learn strategies for how they can fight back against standardized testing and the privatization of public education.
Okay.
Well, I remember when I was in school, which was actually decades ago.
Yeah.
All right. And we had back then, we had things usually once a year, we would have what were called achievement tests. Yeah. But it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, see, that's what I'm wondering is like then, I don't know, I don't even know why they had them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't like they came out in the paper and said, oh, man, the school's really low on their achievement tests.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So that's, I guess, I don't know. It's really weird. But now it's like a really big deal. And I also wanted to say something about Common Core standards, which is what they are, is they are standards. And I tell you, I am amazed at how much I see coming up on the Internet. All these people, I don't know if they're good or bad or whatever, the standards themselves, I'm not qualified to judge that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are so many people who think that it dictates the content that you teach. Rather, what I see is it's a set of standards on reasoning and such and skills that kids could have. And what happens is they go to an appendix, and I can't remember the number of the appendix, and that appendix has examples of children's schoolwork, and they critique the schoolwork and place it in the context of the standards of the child at that age. And what happens is, oh, there was one child that wrote, and these are even PDFs, in the child's handwriting.
Okay.
And one child wrote about global warming, so all the right-wingers like, oh, Common Core makes you teach global warming.
Yeah, yeah.
And other things like that. I just wanted to get that out so that people realize it's not dictating content.
Okay.
I can speak to that, actually. Yeah. So it's important to keep in mind the difference between, I guess I want to make 2 points, the difference between the Common Core standards and the PARC testing. Those are two completely different issues. So the Common Core standards, obviously we want standards. As professional educators, we want standards for learning that kids should, by the time they exit school, should know and be able to do certain things and be able to be productive members of society. The standards do not dictate the curriculum, per se. They're just broad descriptions of what kids should know and be able to do by the end of each grade. The curriculum piece comes in from publishers or, in districts where they write their own curriculum based on what it is kids should know and be able to do. The AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, of which we're affiliates, supports the Common Core standards.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no doubt that some of them could use some tweaking, particularly the early childhood ones. The testing, though, is another issue completely. That, you know, that's that accountability piece.
It's also where people start making some money.
I was going to bring that up.
That's exactly right. And there's no doubt that accountability is important, but really what should that look like?
Yeah. Yes.
And you know, is the PARC test or is standardized testing the way it's being used, right? The way it's being used to judge schools, to judge teachers, based on legislation, you know, No Child Left Behind, and then Race to the Top.
Really a race to the bottom, but yeah. In some
and
ways.
And so those are all things that have impacted the uses of standardized tests. So I think it's important to really keep those things as separate issues.
I just wanted to ask you, is there any real justification for these things needing to be done on computers rather than the old circle, fill in the circle thing? You know, to spend all that money on computers, is there any actual justification for that?
Not that I'm necessarily aware of. I think part of it is they want kids to be getting exposed to technology more.
Well, I mean, I understand that, but
know,
I...
For at least the upcoming PARC, there is an option to take it paper and pencil. Whether that's going to be a permanent option, I don't think so. You know, right now, only a limited number of states are going to be taking PARC this year, and Illinois happens to be one of them. So.
Well, I'm just looking at it like, man, I wish I was a company that's going to be supplying all the computers for this. That's going to be billions and billions of dollars if this stuff's adopted nationwide.
Yes, and schools are already under a lot of budgetary problems. Now, in Illinois, from what I understand, is that the if not all, but a huge percentage of the school funding comes from property taxes. Is that true?
Correct.
Okay. So that means somewhere, like say a very affluent northwestern Chicago suburb.
Like Winnetka.
Okay. Are going to have probably some
example.
Pretty excellent schools. But then when, let's say you get downstate to say, especially rural southern or rural western Illinois, it's probably going to be a whole different story then, right? Or not to mention inner cities. In East St. Louis or Chicago, for instance.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the way the system is supposed to work is that there's this whole formula with the state of general state aid that's, you know, based on a number of things. And so to theoretically should be to even the playing field as far as resources go. But that's not the way it's worked. And for years and years and years, the state has failed to pay or, you know, to distribute the funds that districts were supposed to get. And so for years and years and years, schools, public schools have been underfunded from the state themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, and gee, guess what? Perhaps the state's been underfunded from the federal aid itself, too. This is all related to a real basic thing, which is the flattening and the decimation of the progressive income tax in the United States on the federal level, where there is no longer the ability for the federal government to redistribute resources to needy communities like there was in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Right, revenue sharing, basically.
That's true, and that's all, and I tell you that Ronald Reagan is burning in hell right now. Or he will be, or whatever, for doing that. Well, look at all the hundreds of millions of people he screwed over.
Yeah, yeah.
And then look at the planet.
Yeah. Well, we can go on. We could probably, again, we could probably do a whole program.
Oh, we ought to.
Well, hey, submit it, Bill, and we'll work on it. But anyway, we're going to take a short music break here real quick, and we will be right back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on Listeners Park Community Radio Station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois.
Been in my life, and my voice is about to fall apart, so I'm going to sing the last one, Rather We Are. I bet if I was to make book right now about what that song was, I wouldn't make very much money.
Right.
Which one is it?
Solidarity.
Well, all right. I mean, what that sounds. When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever, for the union makes us strong. dash us into surf, the man would crush us with his might. Is there anything left to us but to organize and fight? For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. We stand outcast and starve amidst the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. All the world that's owned by idle drones is ours and ours alone. We have laid the wide foundation, built it skyward stone by stone. It is ours not to slave in, but to master and to own, while the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever.
Okay, another version of the song, Solidarity Forever. That was definitely Utah Phillips on there. I can recognize the voice. So, okay, so we're back with our two guests, Kathy Mannon, the president of the Champaign Federation of Teachers, and Kevin Farrell, who is a rank and file member of, and a school psychologist actually for, two public, grade schools. So we want to come back, and I think, what maybe we should talk about next is, maybe Kathy, you could start out, and Kevin definitely, you know, pitch in as well as, let's just talk about in general about public education. I mean, why is public education so important?
Well, I think it's no mystery to everybody that public education is really taking a beating across the nation, from organizations whose goal and agenda is to privatize mm-hmm. public education. And, as public education teachers, we are very invested in our schools and our students and our families. And public schools are really the cornerstone of a community. And we all want strong public schools because strong public schools build strong communities. And so it's important to, you know, for teachers to be working together with parents and with the community to keep those schools strong and to really advocate for the resources that are necessary for teachers to be able to do the best work that they can with kids every day. And when we look at schools with higher poverty levels and what are the resources they need to equalize, for kids across districts or kids across the state.
Mm-hmm. And I'll just add to that, and that goes back to the tax issue that we were talking about, where you have schools that are getting funded radically differently based on their property tax base.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's something that was on the ballot back in November and unfortunately did not pass, but mm-hmm. hopefully we'll see that again so that schools are getting equivalent levels of funding.
Mm-hmm.
As far as that goes, is there some kind of constitutional or other legislative thing that's specifies the schools should be equalized in this state, or is there any consideration about that at all?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Nope. I have to research that.
Okay. You know, way back, you know, over a century ago, and still today in some lesser developed countries, when there was no public education system, if somebody didn't have the money to send their child to a school, they wouldn't get an education.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that was, and organized labor, even before there was a teachers' union, was supportive of public education.
Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, it was real common for people at that time. Granted, we were more agricultural based. Nevertheless, though, it was very common up until probably the teens or 20s, and some parts of the country, maybe even later, to where the average working class child or young adult, I should say, by the time that you'd graduate high school, if you went to high school, was that very few, it was actually more common for someone to have less than an eighth grade education, as opposed to even a high school, degree, not to mention any kind of higher education like college or whatever, you know, bachelor's degree or whatever.
Well, and we're seeing now where higher education is starting to become out of reach.
Yes.
For middle class families.
Yes.
Because of the exponential increase in tuition costs, mm-hmm. but not in income.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's also critical to mm-hmm. our nation.
Sure.
Is the opportunity for students to be able to get a higher education degree.
Yes.
If that's something that they want.
When I graduated high school in 1975, the tuition at the University of Illinois was a little over $300 a semester. When I went and got my bachelor's degree in the mid to late 80s, it was $800 a semester. Now, it's over five, I understand it's around 5,000, or more. So you look at, I mean, that's a terrific exponential increase over the years.
Just, oh yeah. Similar you know. To, I was just thinking also years and years and years ago, I didn't even really care if I had health insurance
mm-hmm.
because medical care was not really that expensive. Most people, you know, could get by pretty well with catastrophic care where you had to do like a big hospital stay.
Right.
Man, I could see the same, dynamic mm-hmm. working in education and it's probably like, you know, these colleges, look at the schools around here, I mean, there's all these principals are getting into six figures,
mm-hmm.
big time, you know.
Yeah, not to mention the superintendents, I mean.
Yeah, superintendents, even in these little towns like Bement, Cerro Gordo.
This is public record, but the last superintendent here in Champaign School District made in excess of $300,000 a year. And that was total salary compensation. You know, free health insurance, while, you know, support staff has to pay for it. They were making very little low wages. And plus, he got a clothing allowance and a vehicle allowance. I mean, there's something wrong with that picture. I'm sorry.
Okay, here's something.
You know.
Article 10, Section 1, mm-hmm. Goal. The title is Goal, mm-hmm. Free Schools.
Mm-hmm.
A fundamental goal of the people of the state is the educational development of all persons to their limits of their capacities. The state shall provide for an efficient system of high-quality public educational institutions and services. Education in public schools through the secondary level shall be free. There may be other free education as the General Assembly provides by law. The state has the primary responsibility for financing the system of public education. Okay, that's what the Constitution says. It's a lot of generalities.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's talking about this free stuff. Isn't it, you know, I don't have kids. And Dave, aren't there like physicals and stuff that kids have to get, that parents have to pay for?
Immunizations,
all that.
Costs
like $200 or $300 in order to be in the school.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, I remember we just went down and we got shots. I don't think anybody paid for it.
Many of our families will go to the Department of Health to get those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. See, that's it. I'm so far away from this now.
Okay. You know, since
but I'm just remembering when all this stuff was free back mm-hmm. when we were kids, Dave.
Yes. You know, going back into sort of the issue of, you know, public education in general, I mean, teachers on a regular basis and others, you know, school employees, of course. I mean, you know, in order to get children to up to a certain, like, you know, these standards that they expect them to be at, you're dealing with a lot more than just what's happening during the school day, aren't you? I mean, you know, you're dealing with a lot of many children coming from broken homes, some of you in foster care or should be in foster care, homelessness, you know, poverty backgrounds, having to live in neighborhoods where there's a lot of crime, and I mean basically all sorts of distractions and lack of support you know, in the family or neighborhood, or basically outside of school, to actually be able to do the homework and do well and be able to concentrate. So you're dealing with all that on top of, you know, trying to get them up and, you know, you got a certain amount of hours in the day to get, you know, teach something and get them to the end of the school year. So, I mean, that's true or not? I mean,
it's absolutely true. And we can also add to that list a lack of access to healthcare and efficient and effective, I shouldn't say effective, but a lack of access to mental health care. That's a huge issue for our students also.
Yeah, and now, you know, of course, with these charter schools, which we've covered quite a bit on the show, so I don't really want to delve too much into that, but, you know, in the city of Chicago, I've been following that for quite some time now, quite a few years, and of course, there's a lot of shenanigans going on with, you know, misappropriation of TIF money, and all that. But I mean, basically, you know, when they start these corporate charter schools, I mean, they basically do what's called, I've heard the term, cherry pick and lemon drop, basically. Pick the best students.
correct.
Drop the special needs or less performing students, and then if a student starts to not do well academically, they got an option of kicking them out. Public schools don't have that ability, nor should they, frankly. I mean, you know, as far as that, public schools should be there for everybody. So, I mean, that's a big thing. And still, even with all that, charter schools, you know, when you look at the results over the last decade or so, they don't, on average, they don't outperform public schools at all. In fact, it seems like the record, most public schools do slightly better or about the same as some of the better charter schools.
Now, there is, I'm not sure if you're aware, but there is, charter schools are organizing. IFT, in fact, represents over 1,000 teachers that who work in charter schools. So, you know, I mean, just like their colleagues in public schools, they want to be able to have a voice
sure.
in their workplace.
Mm-hmm.
They're the educational, the teachers are the educational experts. They know what their kids need. They know what resources they need. And so I think, organizing and, having a collective voice in their workplace and in their working conditions, I think, is a positive for
oh, sure.
the teachers who work there.
Mm-hmm. I, you know, the thing is that a lot, well, what's been what I've seen happen in the last, you know, decade or so with these charter schools, though, is that they actually, have a consistent policy of opposing unionization and systematic, arbitrary firing of teachers and, you know, any kind of, you know, support staff or whatever. Not to mention the parents don't have input. I mean, they can go individually, but it's not like they have a school board to go to and stuff. So, I mean, those are the, to me, the big problems with charter schools. Now, there, I've heard that there are some, and there's been a lot of scandals with charter schools, a lot of the fly-by-night corporations, and like, just like in the news story, where they'll open up, and if they start doing, they're not doing well financially, they just close the school down, sometimes in the middle of the term. But there are some legitimate, I guess I've heard, you know, there are fewer in number, actually, community-based charter schools to where there is unionization, and that, the parents have, there's some kind of like, internal governance in the school where there's representatives of teachers, parents, and that. But I think those are very rare compared to the more, corporate models that we're talking about. But I'm glad to hear that there's been more, you know, teachers in charter schools being able to organize and stuff. Mm-hmm. That's good news. That's one step, you know, positive step for sure.
It is still a small amount that are
yes.
Mm-hmm. Unionized. I think I read something this week that was 12%. I think
okay.
It was the number of charter school teachers that are unionized.
Okay. And so, you know, you guys have a contract coming up in a year and a half. You're about halfway through your last mm-hmm. 3-year contract. What were some of the contentious issues last time? Because I remember there was a couple rallies outside the school board that
sure.
I attended.
Yeah. We had some language proposals that we were really trying to get ironed out with the district when we were bargaining the last time that were really important to teachers because they had to do a lot with teacher time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, collaboration, for example, during the school day, the opportunity really for teachers to talk about their students, how their students are doing, what they, you know, what they need to do to move their students forward, to have those professional conversations.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, that was one of the things we were looking at. We, you know, obviously, we did have a lot of difficulty at the table, with financial issues,
mm-hmm.
which we did obviously get resolved,
mm-hmm.
In the end, but it took a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
It took a lot of work on both sides, and both sides were committed to getting that job done,
mm-hmm.
and, we dug in and we did it. And, you know, our members were a big part of that because our members were engaged, our members were informed, our members were showing solidarity in a lot of different ways, which was really powerful for the bargaining team.
And you had members of the community come out from other unions and just in
yes.
general.
Yeah,
you know.
And I think that solidarity forever, right? So how important that really is because it's not, you know, it's the members themselves feeling that solidarity and feeling that more can be accomplished when we work together than when we're separated. But also how important that solidarity is for building stewards when they're going in and having conversations with principals to resolve issues. You know, when the steward knows that they have the people they're representing behind them and really, really on the same page about that issue, that helps them when they go in and have the conversation
sure.
with the principal or when the union leadership is having discussions with district leadership.
Mm-hmm.
solidarity is really important, and we can accomplish more together than we can.
Yeah, that's the to me, that's the central foundation of anything that's considered a union. I mean, seriously. I've been in situations where I was a steward, to where, I didn't know what to do because I didn't know what the policy was because it varied so much of my, how should I put it, the staff of the union, and the membership was not informed. And, I mean, it's like going out on a limb, so to speak. And you don't, you know, you're just, you know, you don't know, you can't give good representation when you're in a situation like that. Where in other situations where I've had good backup and good information, oh yeah, I mean, then it's, you know, how can I say, it's a whole different, you know, situation. You know,
well, the wording of the contracts is sometimes very difficult to decipher.
Well, and how it's enforced, and there's all sorts of other aspects.
It's like the people who write it, they know what it means.
Well, yeah.
But they don't.
And then how do you interpret certain things? Right, see, that's, yeah. You know, like anything else. So anyway, we're going to take another quick music break, and then we're going to come back and kind of have a little bit of a wrap up here. So you're listening to World Labor Hour on Listener Support Community Station WFT. And Bob?
Can you play track 4 if that's what you're going to do?
Yeah, actually track, oh, you want to skip track 3?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay, Bob, what version of Solidarity Forever was that?
That was from the Wisconsin Uprising.
Oh, that was live in the at Wisconsin, huh? Yeah, back a couple of years ago?
Otherwise known as Recall Walker.
So, okay, all right.
And that featured Tom Morello, Jackson Brown, and a bunch of other folks on there. So that was a cool version.
Probably a few hundred people going,
don't know the words.
Yeah. Okay, so we're back here with Kathy Manning, president of the Champaign Federation of Teachers, and Kevin Farrell, rank and file member and AFL-CIO delegate. What about upcoming school board elections? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, locally, we have an election April 7th, I believe, is the mm-hmm. date. And for Unit 4, there are 5 of 7 seats that are up for election. 4 of them are 4-year 4-year terms. One of them is a 2-year term.
Mm-hmm.
So there are 9 candidates, I believe. And I think that the community is going to be really engaged and really going to be informed voters when they go to vote for school board.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there a well, can I tell you what? Let's go to Kevin now because Kevin's the delegate at the AFL-CIO, and let's start out with isn't there a member of a union who's running for school board this time?
Mm-hmm. One of our AFL-CIO delegates, Chris Kloppel, is mm-hmm. going to be one of the school board candidates,
and he's out of the plumbers and pipe fitters.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay, so talk up a little about since you know you're involved with the Central Labor Council, the you know Champaign County AFL-CIO. You're a delegate, and you're also on the executive board. Talk a little about your experiences. You know, since you got on, you know, as a delegate.
Yeah. So, long time CFT member and long time AFL-CIO delegate for CFT, George Cullum. Retired not too long ago, and I was asked to take his place, which I was honored to do. And so I just started attending the meetings, and I really liked what I saw and what I was hearing. There's some fairly new leadership. Matt Kelly is our president.
He's out of the plumbers and pipe fitters as well, right?
Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. And,
but he's also a University of Illinois employee, actually a state worker.
Yeah.
You know, he's out of the building trades, okay.
Yeah, and so is Chris Kloppel, who I mentioned earlier. But,
okay.
You know, I was attending the meetings and trying to be part of the discussion, and ultimately they asked me to be corresponding secretary. They are trying to rebuild the AFL-CIO from the ground up
mm-hmm.
and really increase engagement from all the local labor and really just trying to become very relevant here locally
mm-hmm.
And be involved. And they've got a number of things they're trying to accomplish. One is to get, you know, more labor at the table, local labor at the mm-hmm. table, involved, engaged, solidarity, right? We've heard a lot about that today.
Yes.
And so also, you know, they're trying to accomplish a number of other things from a school standpoint. I know this goes back to the whole college thing and crushing debt from student loans. They really want to have, you know, high school age students get more access to what being a skilled trade worker would look like for those mm-hmm. opportunities outside of high school, which are very, very, it's a very good cause, and hopefully we'll see some of that getting.
Okay.
And I got to suggest.
With collaboration yes. of CFT.
Mm-hmm. I suggest that all the unions that are involved with any kind of public works in Illinois and are worried about this pension start lobbying in Washington DC mm-hmm. because there is enough money in the United States and they could bail these pension plans out if they wanted to. Why don't they quantitatively ease the pension plan?
Hey, I like that.
You know, we'll just throw money at billionaires,
you know,
and not tax them.
You know, I think that's one of the things the AFL-CIO is trying to accomplish here is again, get more local labor leaders and members at the table working towards a common cause.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I never hear of any union ever suggesting, or anybody except me, ever suggesting that the federal government should bail these things out. Have you ever heard anybody else in conversation, in the media, anywhere? No.
Well, I've seen some articles on the internet saying that, so you know,
okay,
you know, the
right
only one,
there,
Bill.
Some other fringe guy.
Okay, but you know, just because your fringe doesn't mean you have a good, you don't have a good idea. And how many?
Well, we can bail banks out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
hell
yeah.
With them teachers and their old age pension funds.
Right, right. Ah. Which leads into the next topic. I want to get in here, Kathy, Kevin, whoever wants to jump in. What's going on now with this whole thing with the teacher state worker pensions? There's been some quite a bit of legal battles going on with that, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, in November, the court. Sangamon County Court did say that the pension clause, that the legislation that was to reform our pensions was not constitutional. So at this point now,
when you say reform the pension, what are you talking about?
Well, they the legislation was changing. Changing benefits?
To your detriment, though,
yeah.
Right? So it's not reform. It's
right.
Actually attack on your pension.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wait a minute. I'm
like
sorry.
This, yeah. I'm trying to remember the specifics.
Yes,
state
sure.
lawyers argue pension. Is that?
Uh-huh.
Okay, this is the Lisa Madigan thing. What it is that they're arguing that that the protection that your side is citing in the Constitution is not absolute. Number two, they're arguing that in case there's some huge epidemic or something, I don't know, maybe an atomic bomb attack or something, they need to somehow get into your pension fund to pay for necessary things.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think it is.
They've already been doing that for a long time.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
That's the problem.
That's Social Security, too, which, you know, so basically they don't get.
We do not get Social Security, which is often a common myth that we deal with it, but we teachers.
From what I understand, the state of Illinois borrowed from your pension plan, which was extremely solvent, and just decided they couldn't pay the money back. Isn't that pretty much it in a nutshell?
Yeah.
They haven't made the payments into the pension.
Okay.
Funds that they
were supposed to. Okay.
They call them pension holidays, I believe.
Listen to this.
Where they come up with this, it's amazing.
According to the circuit court's holding, for example, faced with an epidemic requiring the state to purchase and distribute vaccines, not even temporarily reduce pension. We couldn't even temporarily reduce pension benefits to cover those costs. Lawyers for the state argued. Hysterically.
You could do a sitcom on this, Bill.
I had not heard that. That's interesting. I'm going to have to read that. But
Ebola!
Yeah, if you read the Sangamon County judge's ruling from back in November, it was pretty emphatic that the proposed pension change was completely unconstitutional.
Yes, I remember reading that, too. Mm-hmm. And this has been going on all over the country, too, and not just Illinois. California and other states, you know, and it's, wow. I mean, you know, it's just like, you know, if, whatever profession you're in, I mean, you know, when you start to get to the age to where, you can't, do as well in your job, I mean, or even before then, you know, you need to have ability to be able to, retire and be, you know, comfortable and not have to be destitute like in the old days and either end up having to be a burden on your family or, be homeless, you know.
Yeah. And with the new budget bill, Dave, your pension could be cut right now.
Yes, I saw that, Bill.
With the multi-employer plan.
So they're going after everything. They're going after state pension plans. They're going after Social Security. And then now they're going after, like, our joint employer, you know, private pensions, which were basically governed, though, by ERISA, which was the federal pension management thing. So, yeah, it seems like somebody wants to tap into all these retirement systems to get the money. I mean, am I a conspiracy theorist here or what?
I think it's a place that was occupied a couple of years ago for a while.
Well, and our governor wants it to change to a 401k
style
plan. And Illinois AFL-CIO President Michael Carrigan recently wrote an op-ed about why 401 pensions should not become 401ks.
So indeed.
That was some good reading, too, if you have a chance to look that up.
Okay. Well, I tell you what's wrong with the United States, and that is I am sick of people like Rahner. Oh, I had to meet a payroll, blah, blah, blah. These guys and women, like, say, Carly Fiorina, who's being touted as a possible contender for president, they have no clue. I don't care if they started out poor.
Mm-hmm.
At the point that they are in their lives, middle-aged people in those positions, their culture, their psychology is so different, and they were probably psychopaths to begin with to get to where they are. No, seriously.
Yeah.
That's a common finding, is that the leadership of every realm, at least in the United States, is dominated. No, politics. Everything. Nonprofit organizations, foundations are dominated by psychopaths because it's those qualities that can get you into those positions. You don't care about anybody. You'll do whatever it takes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We could do a whole show on the psychopathy.
Yeah, we got to have you back on, especially
corporate America.
We're going to take a rain check on that. Okay. Well, Kathy and Kevin, thank you so much.
Public school administrator.
Okay. Well, anyway, not all, but anyway, Kathy, Kevin, thank you so much for coming on. And you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on the Support Community Radio Station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned for the Union Edge with host Charles Showalter out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.